Accession number 28750, Reel 14.
Laurie Manton, Reel 14.
Yeah, so the Daily Mail might be running a book extract from a famous personality. And the Sun will run a story at the same time and call it exclusive about that same personality, loosely using the exclusive extracts from the book and saying, as published in the Daily Mail, but doing it as a spoiler. So there's an attempt to spoil the effect of that story because they didn't have that story, which I thought was a particularly dim way of operating it. But that's as far as my extent of the knowledge of the rape camps and such like.
Mm-hmm. Were there cases of rape that you knew of, though?
No. No.
Peter Housen, I believe, he painted pictures of rape, didn't he? You were talking about him earlier, and I wonder, did you ever meet him? You had a very interesting meetings with John Keane in the first Gulf War, I remember.
Yeah, no, I didn't. My association with Peter Housen was being escorted by the same people who'd seen him vanish from the scene with nervous exhaustion, if you like. But in looking at his work, I was obviously interested because I was there at a similar time. But I didn't recognise the pictures that he painted. And I think he acknowledges in several articles that most of his paintings come from the imagination in any case. Well, he'd obviously heard about all these rapes, heard people talk about it and all the rest of it. And I don't think I'm doing him injustice because he had said that, you know, he soaks in the atmosphere and then produces these drawings. So someone must have said to him, and then they got this poor woman and stuck her head down the toilet while they raped her. But if you look at his work, if you look at, you know, a catalogue of his work, the figures are virtually identical to the figures of the football hooligans that he pictured, or dock workers that he pictured. They're just in different positions and situations. So I was very disappointed in what he produced. And he had, you know, 5 minutes of fame through that rape painting. What else did he do that was, really did a lot? Not very much, in my opinion.
Whereas with John Keane, you did identify with what he was painting.
Yes, because, you know, although some people initially found it very difficult to comprehend what he painted, you know, with problem over Mickey Mouse, a fairground ride, lumps of poo on the ground, and a shopping trolley with rocket-propelled grenade rounds in it, but they existed, and it's a true record.
It's the sort of thing you would have done, isn't it? That sort of composition,
yeah,
with your photography.
Yeah, very much so. But you know, it's almost like these things that are popular today, the Peter Housen paintings. They call them graphic novels now. They're illustrated novels of superheroes or nasty goings-on. And that's almost like they are. They're comic images, and I don't think they add anything to the history of the conflict at all.
Were you there during the massacre at Armichi?
No, I was there fairly shortly afterwards. And I remember sitting back at home in Aldershot in Hampshire, thinking, good grief, that's absolutely terrible, realising a couple of weeks later I'd be there. But I was out in a sort of battle area one day, and I had a medic, corporal, Royal Army Medical Corps, in the back of the vehicle with me, and we were stuck there for one reason or another. And I got chatting, and he was one of those that had actually been told to go along and recover the fragments of body and put them in a body bag and remove them from that Seller. And he said that, you know, a medic's job is to, you know, move the wounded, deal with the bodies and things like this. But he found it quite affecting. But he didn't think he would have any, it would have any lasting effect on him. Because I'm always interested in things like shell shock, which then developed into battle fatigue and then has become post-traumatic stress disorder. So I was quite interested in that conversation I had with him. And then one day this guy came out, Royal Army Medical Corps captain, and he was a field psychiatrist. And they started to realise that the soldiers were actually suffering stress out there. And they'd had a number of Royal Engineers who'd been on patrol, who'd been seized for some hours by the serves, and they kept the people blindfolded and every so often took them out and said, "We're going to execute you." Put the gun to the back of the head and pulled the trigger, and they either fired another gun next door to it, nowhere near the head, so the people thought they were dead but they weren't, or it would just be a click, or put the gun, the pistol barrel in their mouths and pull the trigger and I think they were going to die. When you had several hours of that and being beaten as well, you're pretty stressed. So they were debriefed, if you like, which, you know, made life a little easier for them. And I had a conversation with the field psychiatrist, and again my sort of little danger area, and he said, "Gosh, you're a really interesting person who's interested. You know, I'll tell you all about it." And he was saying how they'd been working on the subject since the Gulf War had ended in 91. So there was a serious look at how they were debriefing people that had suffered trauma. And I can refer to a similar thing when I come to discuss Northern Ireland, which is perhaps, you know, more relevant there. But I think undoubtedly there was a lot of stress for people.
Also, I was going to ask you about interpreters, and I imagine you had to use them at times, didn't you, when you were talking to local people?
Yeah, they were locals in themselves, and two I got to know very well. And they were mostly local girls in their 20s, given a uniform, and they travel out into the most dangerous areas with the British troops and interpret.
I would think it's quite a risky job for them, wasn't it? This taking of, you know, being on one side and...
Well, especially being a woman as well. A woman, having the answer to a woman, you know. Dreadful slur on the... Serb male murdering soldier, you know, having the British speaking to them through a woman, you know, absolutely appalling. But they were very brave. They earned a reasonable amount of money. They weren't overpaid, but it meant they were able to, you know, they had the money to send back so their families who were living in poverty could get some food or some firewood or batteries for the radio or things like this. But I used to have conversations most evening in the officers' mess at Vitez with these women, and one in particular was Bob Stewart's interpreter. Now, we're on the side of a hillside where the main British base was in the in Vitez, and they had like portable buildings as cabins for the people to sleep in. And just very occasionally, the two sides might fire at each other and miss. And I remember being over there when shells landed right next to the fence. Of course, you know, the typical British squaddie and us rushed to the fence to see what's going on. It's only when you turn around and saw holes in these portable cabins and chunks of shrapnel going around, you realise how lucky it was that that people weren't injured at all. But just outside the fence, there was a couple of houses, and they didn't have windows, and a couple of officers lived out there, and the interpreters did as well. And they used to sit out on deck chairs of an evening and read a book in their uniform, so the fighting sides would know what was going on. And Bob Stewart's interpreter, who is photographed in his biography that he did, very tall, raven-haired young woman, and she was sitting there, and someone on the hillside a few yards away put a bullet straight through the front of her head, and she lived for some hours and then died. And that was the day I left Vitez, so I talked to her the night before, and then we got in a truck and done the 12 hours down to Split to find that, you know, fly back to the UK. And by the time we got down there, we heard that she'd been killed, and that was a real shock, because she was a very nice person. She'd been involved. She was like the head interpreter. She'd been wherever Bob Stewart had been. She was utterly shocking and completely senseless. But that's, you know, so much of the killing was senseless. There was no reason for it, except a person was a different nationality, if you like. Oh. You know, there's a Bosnian Muslim, bang.
How about the Serb and Croat leaders? Did you ever interview them or meet them? Or the Muslims as well, of course. Did you have a chance to talk to them?
No, I saw them. And because everyone in what was the former Yugoslavia had done national service, if you like, so every male in what was the former Yugoslavia had an AK-47 rifle in the back of their wardrobe, because they were all, you know, active all of the time, but just did a couple of years national service. Although they were dressed in, you know, scruffy combats and such like, there did look to be a bit of a military structure to their way of doing operations. But I remember having a close look at one of their headquarters area, and that was, again, travelling up in stood up in the back of a Warrior infantry fighting vehicle with my photographer, Terry Champion. And there was a roadblock, which was organised by HOS, H-O-S, and they were the pretty nasty mercenary people that killed everyone willy-nilly and rob them. We had two armoured fighting vehicles, and because the UN was so ineffectual, they said, right, you're taken hostage. And the British troops said, yeah, you're not getting in our vehicles, but okay. And they said, well, you must come to such and such a town. And they took us to this town where we all ended up out the vehicles, and it was very risky anyway, because they'd just done the $500 reward for anyone who shoots a photographer. And there's both of us covered in cameras, stood in the open in the back of the vehicle. It's a bit nerve-wracking. But they were very iffy in this town we were taken to, and they were Bosnian Muslims, and they'd been very good previously. And it was to do with our cameras. And what had happened the previous day was, they had a team of cameramen arrive from Croatia to film what they were doing at this headquarters. And then the camera crew went away, and to their horror, when they switched on their satellite television that night, this Bosnian Muslim headquarters saw all the film of their headquarters and their defences in this town showing on Serbian television. They were a Serbian film crew who, from the military, who masqueraded as a TV crew to make a propaganda film of how useless these people are, because we just wandered amongst them. And we were the next ones that turned up. And they made us drive round and round the town for hours, just following one of their vehicles to give us a lesson. And in the event, in the end, when we came near the road after a couple of hours, they said, "Go off, get lost," and we got away with it. But you know, to think myself and the photographer are the ones that caused that bit of aggro, quite worrying.
Did you have much to do with Alastair Duncan when he took over from Bob Stewart with his group, the Kings at King's Own, isn't it?
Princess of Wales Princess Own Oh, Regiment yeah. of Yorkshire. Yeah, I had a lot to do with him, and a lot of conversations with Alastair Duncan. I thought he was really inspirational, and he related well to his men. And it was a funny old time, because there was in charge of the UN forces out there was a French general whose name escapes me now, guy with glasses.
Yes, I know the one you mean. Yes, yeah. I can't think of the name.
No, I'd actually interviewed him so for a few minutes, so yeah, I should remember his name, but I don't. But then he came to inspect the troops at Vitez in the army base there, and so it was Alastair Duncan's people that were on parade. But it was quite interesting, because the French general, who was so ineffective, saying, "No, you know, you can't get involved," and all this sort of thing, was not well received by the British horses, and he's making a speech, and there was a shout, "Get on with it, you old tosser, bloody French," which is quite remarkable, considering how restrained the British forces are in a parade situation. I won't forget that. And they'd drawn up warrior armour fighting vehicles in a sort of semicircle with the gun barrels raised up. And I remember, as soon as that was prayed over, the whole time I was thinking, "Don't move those vehicles, there's a good photo." And someone had just shown me how to focus the camera so everything from right in front of you to the distance is in focus, because sometimes it's blurred right at the start. Because on this sort of grassed area, it was just suddenly come out, was hundreds of different coloured flowers, crocuses and all sorts of daisies and such like. And I'd already worked out that if I lay on the floor and put my lens in amongst the flowers, you have this wonderful carpet of flowers with the white warrior with the barrel sticking up across the blue sky. And I got a fantastic photo of it, and that's all I could think about, not the parade, but all the rest of it. But it was a dead funny time, because I'd had a situation where, although I was there as a journalist for Soldier magazine, I did, if you like, I worked for the public relations staff of the MOD, and a couple of British mercenaries had been murdered. And the troops there owned the clothing from the bodies. They had it held in the army base. And someone had claimed that these two mercenaries were TA soldiers on them, you know, who were illegally out there, shouldn't have been there as they were members of the TA. And the Prime Minister was being asked a question that afternoon. And they needed to know whether they were, who they were, and whether they were members of the Territorial Army. So I had to persuade the army to give me the clothing so I could go through the personal effects. So I had all this bloodstained clothing and their bloodstained pictures of their children and things like that, but managed to identify their national insurance numbers, names and addresses. And then found to satellite photocopies of these documents back to Whitehall, I had to, I faced with a huge queue at the satellite centre of people wanting to send urgent dispatches back to the headquarters. So by force of presence, I had to take over the satellite centre and have all these people ejected, even though I was a civilian and a journalist to boot, so that I could fax this stuff through, and it got through in time. They found out they weren't in the TA, and the Prime Minister was able to...
They weren't in the TA.
No. Yeah. So he was able to say, no, they weren't members of the TA. They were just out of work Glaswegians, looking to make quick bucks. So there were sort of political elements to the work that was being done.
Did you meet any of the Mujahideen there? I'll see them during your time.
One or two. I'd seen a lot in the Gulf. Some of the Mujahideen fighting battalions. But yes, and I did see Mujahideen on a couple of occasions in Bosnia, and they scared the life out of me. Because they were real fighting machines. And there was a big difference between those and people who'd been, ex-national servicemen in the Yugoslav National Army. But they stood out. They really did stand out.
Were there many of them?
I think there were several hundred out there at some stage. I know in the Gulf they had, organised battalions of Mujahideen. But then they fought for themselves. And the same in this case. They go out there and sort out the Serbs and things like this.
I suppose, really, they're all part of this war on terror. What's developed since? A lot of these people, do you think?
Well, the Mujahideen had been heavily involved in fighting the Russians when they invaded. They came to prominence in Afghanistan when the Russians invaded it. They loosely called them Mujahideen in Chechnya, but I don't believe they were authentic Mujahideen.
Perhaps the term's used rather loosely, do you think?
Yeah, it's like the insurgent thing. Some of them are bandits. They almost all have come in, so they must be an insurgent, but some are real bandits, Some are Iraqis, who were determined to fight their own side and all the rest of it. That's easy for a title such as Mujahideen to be hijacked and used in the wrong way.
Did you go to Kosovo after Bosnia? This would have been 99, wasn't it, Kosovo?
No, I didn't go there. I'd been asked whether I wanted to be considered for operational tours. And having been on operational tours a lot between 1990 and 1995, which was the last year I visited Bosnia, I turned around and said, I think I've seen enough of war and I'm a bit traumatised, therefore I withdraw my interest, because it was voluntary. And I know they were considering asking me to go out for the Gulf War II proper, but thought I was doing another job I was involved in, and that would have disqualified me from being considered, whereas they were wrong. I wasn't doing any other job, so I could have been sent on that.
Yes, so would you have been in 95, was that the date of Srebrenica, when that terrible massacre occurred? I wondered if you knew anything about that at the time.
Well, that was quite interesting, because they were having trouble doing resupplies and things like that, and they were using mules or horses to get supplies to our people. And I'm just trying to remember who the British troops were that were in Srebrenica.
Or were they Dutch? Were they Dutch?
Well, the Dutch were there, but there were British as well. The Dutch are the ones who mishandled the thing completely, who let all the people come into their compound who were clamouring for sanctuary.
Your general, whose name we can't remember, he was the one who actually defended Srebrenica earlier on, I think, didn't
That's
he?
That's right, yeah. Yes. Yeah, he went in there and stood on a lorry and said, I'm here saving you, you will be safe.
I'm hoping it would trigger the name for me.
But the Dutch effectively abandoned the people to their fate. But the British troops were there as well, but they were evacuated. And I was sitting, I must have been in Split, and I was sitting under an olive tree on the edge of the airfield. There was a little nappy shop operating in one of these big docking containers that container ships have. And someone said, they're coming. And Hercules had arrived, and it had brought out all the people that had driven overland, left most of their equipment, driven overland, got themselves to an airfield, and they chucked on a Hercules, and they literally just stepped off the aircraft, fresh from Srebrenica. There was about 100 of them, and they all had those mad staring eyes, because they'd seen so many things they hadn't wanted to see, and they weren't seeing anyone. It was quite interesting. I spoke to some of the people in the low-key way, but at that time, the military authorities were very iffy about discussing it, because I think they realised, although it wasn't the British fault, there'd been a big military debacle, and there was a danger of them being swept up in this debacle, whereas the Dutch had let the side down, but they all had these mad staring eyes and weren't seeing anything.
End of reel 14, Laurie Manton. Thank you.